Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona Tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Heritage Voices, episode 81. I'm Jessica Uquinto, and I'm your host. And today we are talking about working with Indigenous communities and orangutan conservation in Borneo. Before we begin, I'd like to honor and acknowledge that the lands I'm recording on today are part of the Nuch, or Ute People's Treaty Lands, the Dene Tah, and the ancestral Puebloan homeland. Today we have Dr. Chua on the show. Dr. Liana Chua is a social anthropologist and Tunku Abdul Rahman University Assistant Professor in Malay World Studies at the University of Cambridge. She has long-term research interests in Malaysian Borneo, where she has explored conversion to Christianity, ethnic politics, and experiences of development and resettlement among Bidayuh communities. She currently works on the social, political, and aesthetic dimensions of the global nexus of orangutan conservation, tracing its operations, transformations, and effects across national and cultural boundaries. So welcome to the show, Liana.
Thank you, Jessica. Nice to be here.
Yes, I'm so excited to have you on. We never get to talk about apes, so like you said, that's exciting.
Only a particular kind of ape, though, just one kind.
Yeah, fair enough. But yeah, so I wanted to ask you first, how did you get into social anthropology and what interested you in this type of work?
Yeah, I kind of got into it by accident. So I grew up in Singapore where nobody had ever heard of social anthropology. And so for my first degree, I studied history. And it was actually through this undergraduate degree in history that I first became exposed to anthropology and also kind of realized that what really, really, you know, grabbed my attention and really interested me were those small human stories about, you know, what people ate, what people lived like, the differences, but also the similarities between humans, and particularly the way that these manifested themselves in, you know, very sort of stark cross-cultural or international encounters, like, you know, moments of trade or religious conversion. So it was kind of, I think, during my undergraduate in history that I started to develop a bit of an anthropological sensibility. I then went off and worked very briefly in a museum and thought I was going to go into a kind of museum career. But then I discovered this MPhil in Cambridge University called something like Social Anthropology and Museum Work. And I thought, oh, this sounds interesting. Kind of combines both my interests. So I rocked up in Cambridge, you know, did this 12-month degree. And within about 2 months, suddenly, you know, had this moment of realization that this was really, really what I wanted to do. So I then applied for a PhD and I was very lucky. I got a studentship and then ended up doing a PhD in Malaysian Borneo with an indigenous group called the Bidayuh.
Yeah. Okay. So I want to back up a little bit to kind of what you were saying at the very beginning, because Singapore is really its own really interesting, you know, anthropological, I don't know what you would call it exactly. But so looking back, you know, because you're talking about all these people coming together and how that shapes people and things like that, did it change the way that you think about Singapore after having this experience in social anthropology?
Oh, yeah, completely. And in fact, I think the seeds were already planted when I was growing up in Singapore, because I think I became very conscious of the fact, you know, when I was a teenager that Singapore was this, as you say, a very, very strange, it's a strange bubble. It's a strange kind of microcosm, right? It's this weird little first world, uber modern, uber developed, and very self-consciously so, you know, country right in the middle of a much larger region in maritime Southeast Asia. Very unusually, it's got a Chinese majority population. It's got a very specific history of immigration and integration. So, you know, I think growing up, I was very aware that we were kind of unusual in the region. But I was also very aware that there was this very strong narrative in Singapore that we always heard day in, day out in school about, I guess you could call it Singaporean exceptionalism, right? We were different. We were special. We were somehow better than the rest of the countries around us because we're more modern, more progressive, you know, whatever. I sort of absorbed that a lot when I was at school, but I also found it slightly disturbing. And I couldn't quite put my finger on why I found that, you know, uncomfortable. And so I think that was partly why I became interested in kind of going back to my own region, you know, back to Southeast Asia to do my PhD fieldwork, because I think I saw this as an opportunity for me to sate that curiosity and to actually have a chance to look more carefully at some of these places that, you know, we just kind of dismissed as these slightly backward neighbors that we were somehow better than, and to actually try to look behind those sorts of stereotypes and these strange images that I'd grown up with in Singapore and to try and understand what exactly was going on behind those stereotypes. So I guess in a way, doing this PhD in anthropology was also partly an attempt to kind of look back at my Singapore upbringing in a slightly different way and maybe try to disrupt some of the assumptions that I'd grown up with, you know, that very much informed the sort of education system and the way Singaporeans thought and in some ways still think about themselves.
Interesting. Yeah. So, okay. So that led you to look at wanting to work in the region, but what specifically drew you to Malaysian Borneo and what specifically drew you to this community that you were working with?
Yes. Yeah, so I think when I decided that I was going to try and, you know, go back to Southeast Asia, try and understand a little bit more about my own backyard, I then went and did a load of reading in the libraries. And while I was doing this reading, I came across this really interesting article by an anthropologist called Robert Winsler. I think he was based in Nevada, I think. And he wrote this really interesting piece about how these rural Bidayuh communities, but also Bidayuh communities in town, were starting to recast their old ritual architecture, and particularly a building that's sometimes been called the head house. So it's a kind of ritual house that has historically been used for rituals, but also been used to store the heads of enemies that they've taken previously, as these new sort of cultural artifacts, right? So he was kind of looking at this transformation of a ritual building with various ritual users into a cultural space. So I read this article and I was absolutely intrigued, because what I'd been finding in my readings was that a lot of the existing anthropological research on Borneo, on Southeast Asia, so this was kind of in the early 2000s, yeah? It was very culturally centered. It was about trying to understand, you know, traditional cultures, traditional ways of life, you know, old rituals, old religions, but not very good at dealing with transformations and changes, which I was fairly sure was happening in this region. So actually reading an article that looked explicitly at that process of change and the way you were kind of rethinking identities and, you know, ritual and so on, got me really interested in trying to understand various kinds of transitions and how people in places like Borneo were living through those transitions and the way that they were exercising their own agency in these moments. So I decided that I would try to find out a little bit more about Bidayuh society. And so at this point, this was a bit of a leap into the dark, right? So I got in touch with various people in Singapore who were in touch with various people in Malaysian Borneo. These were all through regional Catholic networks, which was very interesting, who then put me in touch with a very well-respected and well-known Bidayuh Catholic leader. And so he hosted me for a few weeks. He took me driving around various Bidayuh regions in his car, and we basically visited a whole bunch of villages, including a number of places that Winsler had written about in his article. And I was trying to basically, you know, find a village that was undergoing those sorts of very self-conscious cultural transformations that Winsler was writing about. And so we eventually came to a place called Kampung Bunuk. Kampung means village, and Bunuk was the name of the village. And here we found that there was a little mini museum, as it called itself, that had been set up by the quite elderly son of the village's last ritual chief. So just to give you a little bit of context, most Bidayuhs were followers of an animist ritual complex known as Gawai, up to about the 1960s, 1980s. And then from about the 1980s, this process of very rapid and large-scale Christianization began. So this guy who owned the mini museum had converted to Catholicism a while back, but he still kept his family heirlooms, like, you know, jars and gongs and ritual items, as a repository of Bidayu culture. So he was kind of transforming these old ritual items into forms of culture, you know, in the way that Winsler had described. And what I didn't realize at the time was that this was also, you know, also a means of trying to reassert his family's authority and saying, you know, yeah, you know, we used to be really, really potent and really influential and powerful in the village. And we kind of still are. And here's the proof. Here are our heirlooms and, you know, all our old ritual collections. I didn't know that at the time, but that was also the kind of one of the motivations, I think, for him setting up that mini museum. So we had a little chat. I was just learning Malay, which is the lingua franca at the time. And he basically said, yeah, you know, if you want to come back and learn about Bidayu culture from me, if you want to come and work with me on the mini museum's collection, you'd be very welcome to, you know, come and live in the village. We'll adopt you as our granddaughter. And you know, just feel free. So so I did. So I kind of hung on to those Catholic connections. And several months later, was introduced to another well-respected Catholic lady, Catholic leader, who was from the same village, was from Kampung Bunuk, and she ended up becoming my adoptive mother. And I ended up living with her and her family for a total of 15 months during my PhD and spent a lot of time working at the mini museum. So it was, I didn't know it at the time, but this combination of Christianity, which was very, very influential and central to people's lives, and this interest in old ritual objects ended up becoming the focal point of my PhD research and eventually a book that I wrote about it.
Yeah, so that's kind of interesting too, because in a way you're almost tying back to that original interest in social anthropology and museums. There's kind of an interesting tie back there. So could you talk a little bit about maybe what these collections meant to the community and basically what you found during your time there, what you learned?
Yeah. So my experience with the mini museum was revelatory in all sorts of ways, but not necessarily in the ways that I expected. So one of the first things that happened after I arrived, so I spent about, you know, a month and a half, I think, working with this elderly guy and his wife who taught me a lot about these ritual objects in the museum. And then he suddenly died, which was really, really unfortunate. He'd been ill for a while, and then he suddenly, you know, one day he just passed really quickly, and everybody was a bit shocked and taken aback, and his wife was, you know, in total shock and really upset. And so that threw open all sorts of questions about, you know, what would happen to the mini museum, you know, what was going to happen to, you know, this old ritual knowledge that I'd been partially documenting, and, you know, I wasn't quite there yet. And so that kind of sent my research in all sorts of new directions. And I remember distinctly this moment when I wandered down, you know, into the mini museum during his wake. So, you know, with Catholic wakes, you have about seven nights of prayers in the deceased household. And what you get is you get the whole village, ideally, you know, coming to the deceased household, bringing gifts, bringing food, bringing money to try and give the bereaved family a little bit of support, you know, so that they don't feel ill, they don't feel sad, they don't feel lonely. So it's an incredible moment when you really kind of get this idea of, you know, communitas in action. And so I remember wandering down to the mini museum, and it had been turned into a sort of gambling den, because people often kind of, you know, do a bit of gambling, you know, play some cards, they drink beer, they were kind of eating peanuts and chucking the shells on the floor, very, very normal stuff for a wake. And I had a chat with a group of, you know, kind of middle-aged men who were sitting there, and they were asking me about the research that I was doing. And I said, yeah, I'm here to study Bidayu culture. I want to understand all about your culture. And one of the guys turned to me and he said, oh yeah, well, you know, all this stuff is our culture. So he kind of gestured around the room, you know, towards all the objects that were on display, all the stuff that this guy had put together in the museum. This stuff is our culture. It's the old ways. But, you know, if you come back here in about, you know, 10, 15, 20 years time, it's not going to be here anymore. You're just going to find us sitting here eating peanuts and drinking beer. And that's basically it. And I think at that point, I suddenly realized that actually people were not as interested in culture, in this concept of culture as I thought they had been. I suddenly realized that the sorts of processes of transformation of you know, ritual things into culture that Winslow had been describing and that this guy had been doing through the mini museum was not being shared across the village. People were not that interested in creating a sense of BWU culture in the same way. This was very much the project of one particular guy. So although I learned a lot from him, you know, I suddenly realized that I didn't fully, he was a very specific section of that village. And to really, really understand what was going on in the village, I had to start looking elsewhere. I had to try and understand, you know, what was actually going on in people's everyday lives, which is, you know, that's one of the great things about anthropology, right? You've got that sort of inductive impulse. You realize that the questions that you started out with were not the same. And then you find other questions that really matter to people. And so I had a bit of a panic at that point. I was like, oh my God, I'm, you know, what do I do? They're not interested in culture. What am I going to talk about? And at that point, I then realized, you know, I was sitting there, it was awake, they were saying the rosary and lots of prayers upstairs. And I suddenly realized that actually what seemed to matter in these situations was Christianity. It was sort of Christianity that was structuring people's lives, Christianity that absolutely infused the way they understood what was going on around them. And as I later discovered, Christianity that was shaping the way they related to the old ritual objects and the old ritual practitioners and the spirits and what they were doing. So again, you know, I sort of ended up doing this strange loop where I started with culture and museums, veered away from it because I realized that people weren't talking about culture in the same way, but then sort of came back to this question and via a rather circuitous route through the study of Christianity. And what I was realizing was that the experience of converting to Christianity was what was encouraging people to differentiate between the old ways, you know, ritual, as performed properly by the old practitioners, the spirits that were associated with these rituals, and culture, as it could be manifested in objects, in certain items of dress, in certain songs, certain dances that could be safely incorporated into their everyday Christian life. So culture is something that was based on the old ways, but that was somehow compatible with BWU Christianity. And I don't think I would have quite set off on that path if I hadn't had that moment sitting in the mini museum with those guys who just said, nah, we're not that interested in culture, really. So yeah, that's what happened in a nutshell.
Yeah, that's an interesting journey, like going back and forth in the different directions. I feel like that's how it always goes with anthropology. Mm. But we are already at our first break point, which is crazy. Yeah. But we will be back here in a minute.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
Okay, so we're back. We were just finishing talking about your PhD experience. And can you talk a little bit more, like, after you finished your PhD, how did you decide where to go from there, and where did you go from there?
Yeah. Okay. So after my PhD, I thought, you know, I should try and make full use of the linguistic, the cultural skills I picked up, because, you know, it'd be a bit of a shame otherwise. And I thought I'd really like to carry on, you know, doing research with BWUs. And so as I was writing up my PhD, I was back in Sarawak catching up on stuff. When I heard about this dam project that was being planned about half an hour's drive away from where I'd been doing my field work. So this was a neighboring, quite closely related Bidayuh region where a very large tributary of the Sarawak River had been earmarked by the government to create a new dam that would help to secure the capital city's water supply. So it wasn't a hydroelectric dam, it was just a straightforward kind of reservoir that would benefit the capital city. And so there were four quite small and quite relatively remote Bidayuh villages that were located in the mountain range that this tributary ran through. They were between about 3 to 5 hours walk from the nearest road up these quite steep hills and across lots of small rivers and things, and big rivers, in fact. And so I became really interested in this situation. And I thought, you know, since I've looked at religious change and ethnic politics in my PhD fieldwork, it might be quite interesting to look at a different kind of change, which was all about environmental transformations and the way that people were experiencing what could be really quite a radical rupture from a sort of Sweden agriculture-based life up in the hills to a much more kind of urban and quite likely wage-earning life in an official resettlement site along the road that was not in their customary land. So a year after I finished doing my PhD fieldwork, I got a research commission and funding to come back and start a new research project with these four villages that were affected by the dam. And what I was basically trying to do was understand their perceptions, their experiences of resettlement, but also by extension, really quite drastic environmental change. So this was only meant to be a kind of 2 or 3 year project because the inundation was actually due to start, we thought, in about 2010, 2011. As it happened, this turned into a much, much longer research commitment that I'm still very invested in all sorts of ways, albeit mostly from a distance these days, because it took a lot longer than that for the whole thing to play out. There were various complications along the way. There were a lot of disagreements among the affected communities. And one of the most interesting things I found was that a pretty significant majority of the affected villages were actually keen to move to the resettlement site. And there were lots of different reasons for this. Some people felt that they really wanted to give up the backbreaking work of rice planting in quite a difficult to reach area, you know, where they didn't necessarily have easy access to hospitals, to schools, to shops and their relatives in town and stuff, and to become modern and to, you know, kind of start earning wages instead of being rice farmers. Some people just weren't that keen on moving, but then they felt they had to move because the little village schools and village health facilities were being closed down and moved to the resettlement site. So they had to move with these facilities to make sure that their children had a good future. And some people just kind of, you know, fancied a bit of a change. So quite a lot of people were actually keen to go, even if they weren't necessarily happy about leaving their customary lands behind. And then a small but fairly significant minority were very against moving out of their ancestral lands. And so as my research progressed, I initially started out working with a broad cross-section of the four affected villages and trying to understand, you know, different perceptions of resettlement, why different people wanted to do different things. But as time moved on, I sort of gradually became more interested in a small group of people who were quite actively resisting resettlement and who undertook this very painful and very long-running legal case that went on for about 6 years to obtain official recognition of their customary land rights in their areas directly above the inundation zone, so right above the new reservoir, rather than be forced to move down to the resettlement site. And so I ended up, you know, as my research progressed, focusing a little bit more on their experiences of going through this Indigenous rights case, the way they worked with lots of different parties, including lawyers, you know, politicians, Indigenous movements, the media, all sorts of well-meaning journalists who were coming from different parts of Malaysia and the world, to try and sort of build up this project to stay where they were for various reasons. And so that sort of became I didn't quite mean it to end up that way, but once I started getting pulled in that direction, it became harder and harder to maintain my connections with the other people who are all kind of dispersing and moving out to the resettlement site or to, you know, urban areas with their compensation money. And so it was an interesting case, again, of kind of following a lead. But in this case, it ended up really narrowing my research focus onto this one particular case and the experiences of these people who resisted resettlement. And in the end, after about 6 years, and against all expectations, these guys won. They ended up building a brand new village from scratch in their ancestral lands right above the dam itself. And they're still there today. And now I've sort of slightly shifted my research focus to try and understand what exactly it is they're doing to survive in this new village that, you know, had previously been just inconceivable, that the state and they and other Bidayuh simply had no conceptual room to imagine. But it is there. So the question is, you know, what do we do when we're actually in this place? How do we make a new village and keep it going somehow? So yeah, that's where I am now. But it's been a really long-term research thing that's stretched out for over 15 years now.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, that's very impressive, amazing, very exciting for this group of people that they were able to make that happen. You know, you hear so many stories where that doesn't happen. So that's really awesome. And I'm curious, you know, going through that experience, you know, with this group of people, I'm sure that there were a lot of learning moments. So can you talk about what some of those were for you?
Yeah, no, there were loads of learning moments. And I think possibly the biggest learning moment was when I realized, you know, after having started doing research in these four villages, that I think all my kind of slightly romantic, you know, I wanted to change the world preconceptions had to be held in check for a bit. Because, you know, normally if you're sort of coming in from the outside and you look at a situation like that, generally, or at least my instinct is to think, oh my goodness, you know, small squashed indigenous group bravely fighting against big bad government that's trying to resettle them. And I think I realized very quickly that actually it was much more nuanced and complicated on the ground than I could have expected, you know, just coming in from the outside, realizing that actually so many people, for whatever reason, wanted to move to the resettlement site and, you know, genuinely believed in this project of modernity and kind of, you know, becoming modern and people and becoming urban, really sort of disrupted any preconceptions I might have had about what Indigenous people might actually want. And I think at that point, I suddenly realized that there was a risk that I'd been sort of slotting them into a slightly naive, you know, black and white moral dichotomy. And so that kind of pushed me to start taking a lot more seriously the different ways in which people were articulating their desire to move, you know, the different aspirations and hopes and concerns and fears that they had. You know, it wasn't as if all of them were brainwashed or something, or that they were all kind of selling out. There were lots and lots of different reasons that people felt that a move to the resettlement site was a good idea. And I had to take those seriously. So, you know, I've been very, very cautious in writing about this situation of making it sound like this was just a straightforward case of an Indigenous group, you know, being squashed by a government. I mean, I think, you know, it's important not to downplay the power dynamics that were involved and the fact that no matter what happened, these communities were still very much on the back foot. But at the same time, you know, there were various sort of glimmers of agency and hope and aspiration that we really can't dismiss. We have to really try to understand and grapple with as anthropologists, even if it feels uncomfortable to us. So that was one thing, kind of, you know, learning to take seriously the people who genuinely wanted to be resettled, the guys who did want to move eventually. But I think the second thing, and this is sort of related, was trying to figure out how to deal with the anti-resettlement group. Because, you know, I think in many ways, the anti-resettlement group saw me as a potential resource. You know, here I was, an anthropologist, you know, with good connections, big schooling, as they say, who could help them with their resistance to the resettlement scheme. Now, I was in a slightly awkward situation because I was there on a research permit, which very, very clearly said, you know, you are not to get involved in any of this stuff. They were aware that this was a very, very contentious scheme. And they, you know, very clearly said, you know, if you get involved in any sort of activism or anti-resettlement activity, you're out, right? And I think, you know, actually that's one of the constraints that as anthropologists, we very often don't talk about. We have to deal with these bureaucracies and these these threats and risks to both ourselves and our interlocutors. And we need to take those seriously as well. But of course, the other point was that I was also very aware that it was difficult to paint a simplistic, you know, black or white moral picture of the situation, because I knew there were so many people in the situation who actually did want to move. So there really wasn't a clear sort of, you know, right or wrong in this case. And so I think knowing that made me sort of pause and try and figure out how best I could work with this anti-resettlement group. And so I made it very clear to them that I was limited in how much I could support them, and that, you know, I would basically be there to try to help them document and talk through their experiences. You know, I try to capture the stories, the lived experiences that they were going through, but I could not in any way advocate for them in any sort of explicit way, because that really wasn't within my remit or my capabilities. And I think they understood that. So I stepped back. I spent a lot of time listening and learning and recording. You know, I captured oral histories, stories about villages, about ancestors, particular families, individuals, relations with the environment, ritual, religious beliefs, including with Christianity. And I wasn't quite sure what I'd do with a lot of this material in the end, but I felt that it was important to be listening and documenting this stuff. And then eventually, as it happened, at one point when the Indigenous rights case was being prepared, one of the people who was helping with this case, who was in fact also an anthropologist from the local university who was working with the lawyers, got in touch and said, look, you know, you've got all this documentation, all these oral histories, you know, all these stories about the landscape. We need to collate material and evidence for this case. Are you willing to share that with us? And, you know, for me, that was one way that I felt that I could actually help and stand with my interlocutors without necessarily being overtly involved in resisting the scheme. And so I sort of handed over a lot of the material that I collated, and that was then combined along with other material, including archive sources, you know, other oral histories, into this much bigger portfolio of evidence that was then used to make a case for their native customary land rights in the area. So it sort of, I played a very, very small part in that. And I think what that made me realize was, you know, sometimes it's not about shouting as loud as you can, or, you know, kind of getting directly involved in politics or activism. Sometimes it is about just stepping back and kind of just shutting up and listening and documenting and collecting stories. And sometimes that will then give you a chance to make a difference in a small way, but in a way that can actually be beneficial to your interlocutors. So that's a really important learning moment that I've hung on to, I think.
Yeah, so obviously it's been some time, sounds like, since this legal battle happened. And you mentioned this interest in, you know, how do you create a new village? So how are things going for this community? What has been happening to them since then?
Yeah, that's very much an open question. So the new village was created in the mid 2010s, so kind of 2013, 2014. Inundation happened in 2015. And so at that point, the old villages in the mountain range were inundated. They're underwater now, mostly. And you know, my friends can still sort of stand on the hills above their old village and kind of look down on the waters, and you can see exactly where things were. It's a very, very sort of strange, eerie, you know, drowned landscape. We've got these dead tops of trees and tall clumps of bamboo sticking out of the water. So they've been very adaptable. So one of the difficulties is that although they got the legal recognition to their native customary land rights in the area, the government has still not recognized their new village. So, you know, the government's recognized their land rights, but it has not agreed to register this village as a village. And so it hasn't given them the same sorts of amenities and support, like, you know, medical care and, you know, funding for gravity feed water systems, solar panels, that sort of thing that they'd normally give to rural villages. And this means that my friends are having to be very, very resourceful and creative about finding ways of surviving in this new place. So at the moment, I'm sort of looking at the different strategies they've come up with to try and, you know, make things livable in this new village. And these include things like they've been trying to set up their own ecotourism scheme where they pick up visitors at the dam entrance and they zip across the water in this new boat, for half an hour, and they get there and, you know, there's beautiful views and an ecotourist lodge and everything. They've been setting up new agricultural, small scale agricultural schemes where they can sell, you know, sort of nice organic village produce to supermarkets, to buyers in town. So there's lots of different ways that they've been trying to make things work. And they've been trying to create these new alliances as well with NGOs and with donors and churches who will then give them, you know, the material and financial support to do things like create a mini hydro system for their electricity and to build a new village chapel and so on. So it's been really interesting kind of watching these different strategic, you know, and often very speculative efforts coming together in this one space. But it is tough. You know, they're still very much in a marginalized and quite sort of, I guess, difficult position without official governmental support. So there's still a very big question mark here as to what's actually going to happen to this village and how sustainable it's going to be in the long term. So, yeah, that's what I'm looking at now.
And on that note, we are at our second break point. So when we come back, we'll talk about your work with Indigenous communities and orangutans. So everybody, stay tuned for that.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Okay, so we are back from our break. So yeah, let's dive in. How did you get from that work that you were doing to your current work working with these, or I don't know if it's even these same communities, but Indigenous communities and orangutans?
So with the resettlement project, I began thinking a lot about how people experience very radical and very rapid environmental change. And at the same time, I was also looking at how, you know, people, especially my interlocutors who were in the anti-resettlement group, were engaging very strategically and very creatively with a whole range of different international or national rights movements, you know, activists, advocates, in very different ways in order to draw attention to their cause and try and, you know, kind of build support for the anti-resettlement legal case. And so that sort of combination of experiences of environmental change and engagement with international movements and politics got me started thinking about what was going on elsewhere in Borneo. And, you know, at that point, I started thinking more about how these questions could be applied to another major industry across the island of Borneo, but also Sumatra, which is orangutan conservation. So a very, very well-known, very charismatic and prominent inhabitant of the island. So at that point, I decided to try and shift my attention a little bit to understanding the social, political, cultural, and also aesthetic dimensions of orangutan conservation, and especially the sorts of ground level complications and tensions that conservation programs could generate, you know, by looking at the interactions between conservationists and indigenous villages and orangutans. Now, I should say that this research has been very different to my previous research in the sense that it's all been done collectively as part of two research projects, one called Bokok and the other one called The Global Lives of the Orangutans, which involved me working with a small team of postdocs and PhD students on creating this multi-sited ethnography of this global network of orangutan conservation. And I think this was really important for a couple of reasons. One was a very pragmatic reason, which was when I started doing this research, I was not in a position to actually do long-term fieldwork in Borneo. I had two small children at the time, and it was just impossible for me to do, you know, what I'd done for my PhD and my postdoctoral research. And so I thought it'd be much more useful for me to be able to work with a team of people who could, in fact, do that sort of work, but then sort of keep that conversation going as a team. And the second reason was simply that, you know, this conservation is a huge, sprawling, incredibly complicated and problematic global field. And it's exactly the sort of thing that you can't study in one place, which is what anthropologists have conventionally done. So what these two projects tried to do was actually pull together ethnographic research and fieldwork and perspectives from quite specific nodes of orangutan conservation across the world, including the UK, kind of international scientific and artistic imaginaries, which was what I was working on, and then very specific rural areas where conservation programs were unfolding and very often causing these complicated interactions between humans and apes and conservationists. So we've just tied up both of those projects. It's been a really, really exciting and very rewarding experience working with my colleagues. And I just want to say that, you know, anything else I say at this point is reflective not simply of my own research, but also of our collective discussions and the way we've been thinking and writing together as a team for the last several years. So I think essentially what we're interested in is trying to understand how ideas and people and finances and all sorts of other things move from one place to another across the globe, right, in orangutan conservation, and the effects that these movements generate in different sites on the ground, and also the way that these movements may or may not enable orangutan conservation to hang together. So we're as interested in the sorts of gaps and slippages and points of conflict in orangutan conservation as we were in the way that things actually connected and held together and kind of moved from one context to another. So yeah, that's basically where we got to. I can't remember what the question was.
The question was basically just how the one led to the other. So,
right.
Yes.
I've gone way past that.
Yes. Which is great. So can you talk a little bit more about like your specific role and like what that has looked like on more of a, I guess, day-to-day basis?
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of my work has been in kind of leading these two research projects. So, you know, making sure we're reading together, we're thinking together. I usually take the lead on co-authored pieces. You know, there's quite a strong sense of responsibility for all the research that's being carried out as part of these two projects. My specific research ended up focusing on the digital manifestations of orangutan conservation. So I started out by looking at the social media scape of orangutan conservation. It's this really strange sort of, you know, dispersed space in which people who shared a common interest in saving these apes from extinction came together, and the kinds of politics and, I guess, modes of intervention that arose as a result of those interactions. So in one of my articles, I wrote about how, you know, very often orangutan conservation organizations try to raise funds and awareness for their causes by using what I call a logic of small acts. So it's this idea that, you know, even though you're somewhere in the West and you don't have the expertise or the time or the money to actually be physically there in the field, in the forests, saving orangutans, as people like to see it, you can still contribute in lots of small ways. And cumulatively, those small acts can make a genuine difference on the ground. So that's the kind of logic through which many conservation organizations raise their funds and get people invested in their causes. Another thing I did was look at how different visualizations of orangutans, but also orangutan extinction, biodiversity loss, you know, all these related questions were being produced by both science and popular media. So, you know, extinction is a very, very difficult thing to visualize, to pin down in concrete terms. So one of my questions was, how do you visualize the extinction of the orangutan, right? How do these things come to take visual shape and visual form? And what kinds of politics do these give rise to? So I was kind of looking a lot at how these, you know, these discourses and these narratives and these visual imaginaries that shape orangutan conservation, that get sent out across the world to places like Borneo and Sumatra, where orangutans actually exist, are being created, what they actually do, what effects they have as they move across this global network of orangutan conservation. And I was also drawing partly on my earlier research, you know, up in the hills with Bidoe communities, where orangutans are not, you know, they're not really seen very much. They're not very much a feature of everyday life, but people are sort of vaguely aware of them because they occasionally do pop up, and so do conservationists. But that's a slightly different story. So I was trying to pull all these different insights together, you know, to try and understand what's going on at the source of these conservation narratives and organizations. And then I had a number of different people working on different nodes of orangutan conservation that we then, you know, that we could then sort of pull together. It was like assembling the pieces of a jigsaw, right, to try and pull together this bigger picture of how this network operated. So I was here looking at these visualizations and ideas as they moved around the world and digital spaces. One of the postdocs on my team was working with UK-based orangutan adoption schemes. So it's these schemes that UK-based charities run to try and get money and, you know, get support for orangutans that are being rehabilitated over in Borneo and Sumatra. And then I had two PhD students, both of whom were working at very specific conservation sites, but in, you know, very, very, very much looking at the interactions between ordinary people and conservationists. And then another postdoc who was in rural central Kalimantan, looking at a new community conservation scheme in an area where there are lots of wild orangutans that had been set up by this Western conservation research group. And so we were all kind of, you know, we were all doing fieldwork and research at the same time. And we're all talking to each other constantly and trying to pull together, you know, our insights and findings and descriptions from these different bits of orangutan conservation to try and build up this slightly fractured and slightly weird picture of how this one conservation nexus operates. And it was absolutely fascinating stuff. So yes, that's what I did. But it was very much in relation to other bits of that, of those two research projects.
Okay. So first of all, when you said that, when you were talking about orangutans not being, or, you know, popping up every now and then conservation's popping up, I just had this image of like the stereotypical conservationist with like their Indiana Jones outfit, like just popping out of nowhere. So... But before we get too far from your methods, I'm just curious, you know, your experience as, you know, you're from Southeast Asia, but not the communities that have orangutans or that you've worked with. But then you're also working, you know, you're also looking at this project at communities in the UK, you know, where you're living and across the world. You know, as a social anthropologist, what was that like for you looking at, you know, like obviously you're connected in some ways to all these different communities, and also, you know, did it affect the way you related to, you know, the people you were studying in the UK versus like, you know, in Borneo, for example, just if you had any reflections on that experience?
Yeah. It's a really tricky question because, you know, I think in many ways that this experience has... It's really blurred the binaries, you know, the divisions that tend to dominate contemporary and, you know, popular understandings of anthropology, right? Because, you know, historically there's very much this stereotype of anthropology, which in some ways gets reproduced in, you know, doctoral training programs in universities all over the global north as the science of, you know, white Western individuals going out to study non-Western radically different cultural others. And that, you know, obviously anthropology's changed a lot since those days. But I think that image is very much alive and well. And it still gets baked into, you know, the way we teach our students about fieldwork, you know, participant observation, dealing with otherness, taking seriously, you know, that sort of thing. And it also, you know, it very often infuses our theory because a lot of our sorts of conceptual insights come from the revelations that you're expected to get when you're confronted with radical otherness, you know, radical cultural difference. And so, you know, I think I've always been very aware of this because as a sort of, you know, as a Singaporean, Southeast Asian anthropologist working in the UK for a long time, but with indigenous groups in Borneo, I've been very aware that I don't quite fit that sort of white Western anthropologist mold. And this was absolutely clear to me even when I was doing my PhD. You know, I was definitely not, I didn't necessarily feel like I fitted very well into that stereotype, which in a way we were all being encouraged to live up to in our PhD training program. And so I think it became a little bit more obvious to me when I was doing this research, you know, on orangutan conservation, because in some ways, it felt sometimes like when I was talking to people at events, you know, in the UK, at demonstrations, at charity events, I sometimes felt a little bit uncomfortable in the sense that it almost felt as if they were looking at me as if I was one of those Southeast Asians, very generic Southeast Asians, right? One of those people who lives, you know, over in Southeast Asia, not quite alongside orangutans, but in the same countries, in the same regions. And I think, you know, in people's minds, you know, if you sort of mention that, I'm pretty sure they'd say, no, you're obviously different because you're Singaporean and they're, you know, indigenous people in Borneo or Sumatra or whatever. I often sort of felt like there was an attempt to sort of, there was an assumption of complicity which made me feel quite weird in the sense that it was assumed that I was, you know, that because I was over here and I spoke good English and I was an anthropologist, that I would therefore be complicit with this slightly, not slightly, I mean, very often, you know, completely colonial view of what was going on in Borneo and Sumatra, where, you know, there were these ignorant, uneducated, you know, cruel natives who did not understand the value of orangutans and were not good environmental subjects, just kind of, you know, just shooting them at will and being really horrible to them. And either that or just not understanding why they were important, right? So we got to educate these poor people. And there was a little bit of a sense that, you know, I was being pulled into that space, that there was an assumption that I sort of belonged in that space. But at the same time, people were a little bit sort of wary of me just in case, you know, I didn't necessarily share the same values as they did. So I remember having this slightly weird conversation where, you know, we were talking, I can't remember who it was, but I was talking to somebody at some random event about how, you know, some people in Borneo still hunt and consume orangutans because why not? You know, they're just any other mm-hmm. game that you might encounter in the forest. And there was, and this guy was like, these people will just eat anything, won't they? You just never know what sort of diet they have. And then he sort of paused and sort of looked at me, and you know, I could sort of almost imagining him thinking, ooh, is she Chinese? Chinese eat everything, don't they? Am I saying the right thing here? And so there was always this really uneasy, you know, I wasn't quite sure, and they were never quite sure whether I was fully complicit and fully with them, or whether I was part of that other who they were trying very hard to be sympathetic towards and understand, right? So it was a really weird one. You know, there was no overt hostility, but there was very much this sense of, ooh, do I or do I not get enrolled into these very sort of colonial assumptions about what's going on the ground in places like Borneo?
Hmm. Yeah, so did that experience like make you think at all about like, or think in different ways about, you know, how you might have been perceived by the communities in Borneo? Just curious, like...
No, I don't think so, because certainly for the Bidoyi communities that I've worked with for a long time, I've always known how they perceive me.
Yeah, okay.
You know, they've always perceived me as, or I mean, certainly, especially when I was younger, you know, they always called me Tina, you know, which just means, oi, you know, Chinese person, right? That Chinese girl. Because I was from Singapore, by definition, most people in Singapore are Chinese and most people in Singapore are rich. So there was always a little bit of that going on anyway. And, you know, sometimes I'd get kind of, you know, requests like, oh, could you buy me some, buy me a nice present, or oh, could you help me find, you know, my cousin a job in this or that Chinese shop in the town? And obviously I couldn't because, you know, I basically couldn't, but there were these stereotypes that they had as well. So, you know, I think they were very clear that I was not a white Western anthropologist. I was a girl from Singapore who was, you know, doing big schooling, as they said, in the UK. But they didn't relate to me necessarily as a white person.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think I've always been aware of that. As to how I might be perceived by, you know, some of the indigenous communities that maybe my postdocs and PhDs worked with, that's a really interesting question. And I think that would depend on the context in which I was introduced to them. So if I came in, for example, you know, under the auspices of a conservation organization, I might either be seen as, I mean, they know I was, they call me Chinese anyway, but I think they'd sort of basically link me with either, you know, these middle class urbanites from Jakarta or, you know, the cities, or with white people. And that would be a slightly different proposition because they're often quite suspicious of conservation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So can you tell us a little bit about what, you know, so we talked about methods, but what did you actually find when you were doing this research?
We found some very interesting things. Maybe they're not entirely surprising, but they were still very interesting. So I think maybe the first thing to say is that it became very, very clear to us very early on. And I think I already knew this anyway from my previous fieldwork, that this kind of international, you know, mostly Western global North fascination with orangutans as this charismatic, unique, endangered species isn't necessarily shared in the forests where orangutans actually live. And so a lot of our time was spent actually trying to understand what people thought about orangutans, you know, in these spaces. And generally, I think we can say that most indigenous communities in Borneo don't see orangutans as particularly interesting or special or exceptional. You know, they're very much part of this wider multi-species environment. So in an environment in which there are lots of living beings, including trees, rivers, animals, humans, spirits, that are bound by certain relations and certain ties of, you know, accountability and reciprocity. So there's certain moral codes that you expect to find across all living beings in a lot of these environments. And so, you know, I mean, most of the time, if you're an indigenous person and you encounter an orangutan in the jungle, you'd be like, meh, whatever, you know, no big deal, nothing interesting. Sometimes you might hunt it and kill it and eat it. But, you know, you wouldn't necessarily see it as particularly special or particularly interesting or different to any other primate that you might encounter. And so I think one of the big problems and one of the big sources of tension that we found in our research is that what conservation does is it disrupts this moral and social fabric, because with the backing of the state and with laws and stuff, it comes in and it plucks this one animal that nobody necessarily sees as special or exceptional out from this multi-species fabric, this wider environment, and makes it special. It makes it super visible, you know, super protected, and therefore no longer bound by the same sorts of relations and conventions that govern life in these environments. It's conservation that sort of makes the orangutan exceptional. And this very often comes, you know, people feel at the expense of indigenous land rights, their access to their customary land, to their livelihoods, because what you tend to find in these spaces is that, you know, conservation programs will come in the name of saving orangutans, will demarcate certain areas that they see as theirs, you know, their customary lands as protected forests in order to save orangutans. And this means restrictions on livelihood. So you can't, you know, stopping people doing swidden cultivation because, you know, there's a lot of burning going on, stopping people logging trees in their own forests, restricting people's access to their customary lands and so on. So the problem here is that, you know, conservation doesn't only kind of pluck orangutans out of this wider moral fabric. It also does so at the expense of indigenous people's well-being and rights and access to land. And that causes tremendous problems in these spaces and a lot of resentment about what exactly it is conservationists are doing in these spaces. So, you know, another interesting thing that we found is that for many of our indigenous interlocutors, you know, conservationists are very often not seen as any different to other external players, you know, like companies or the state or tourists or whatever. You know, they're all seen as these quite powerful and well-resourced outsiders that have some sort of vested interest in indigenous people's lands, just for different reasons. So, you know, companies might want to extract stuff from it and conservationists might want to protect it. But in both cases, local communities, you know, just end up losing out. So yeah, it's not very cheerful, but there you go. That's the reality on the ground at the moment.
Well, on that cheerful note, we're right at the end. Was there any last, you know, little things that you wanted to share, or make sure that our listeners understood before we go?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't want to end on too depressing a note. So, you know what, I think it's really important to be aware of the many historical and contemporary problems that conservation has caused. You know, I think there are also various organizations and individuals who are working very hard to make conservation better and to improve their engagements with local communities, you know, make sure that what they're doing doesn't only benefit a particular species, but can also work to benefit humans and their environments. It's a very, very difficult balancing act, but, you know, there are openings and there are possibilities. And there are people who are really trying to make that change on the ground, many of whom are kind of from, you know, from the region, from Borneo and Sumatra themselves, and who have a very different kind of vested interest in what goes on in these spaces. And so I think what we're seeing emerging at this point is, you know, kind of new ways of doing conservation that are relatively unusual, but that I hope will kind of create more room for, you know, the coexistence of different values, different methods, and yeah, different ways of relating to both humans and non-humans.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on and sharing. Really appreciate you taking the time, especially since you're in the UK, so it's much later where you are right now.
Yeah, it's getting dark now.
Yes. But yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the Heritage Voices podcast. You can find show notes at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/heritagevoices. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the Google Play Music Store. Also, please share with your friends or write us a review. Sharing and reviewing helps more people find the show and gets the perspectives of Heritage Voices' amazing guests out there into the world. Don't we just need more of that in anthropology and land management? If you have any more questions, comments, or show suggestions, please reach out to me at jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. If you'd like to volunteer to be on the show as a guest or even a co-host, reach out to me as well, jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. You can also follow more of what I'm doing on Facebook at Living Heritage Anthropology and the nonprofit Living Heritage Research Council, or on Twitter at Living Heritage A. As always, huge thank you to Lyle Belenqua and Jason Nez for their collaboration on our incredible logo.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.